Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everybody, it's Eric Beiler here with Annabelle Park. Welcome to our virtual town hall on immigration. As you probably know, Annabelle and I have been involved in and interested in this issue for a long time. Annabelle herself is an immigrant from South Korea, and like most Americans, my family history involves immigration. And I'll talk a little bit about that, actually, because many people may not know this, but the very first immigration law that we had in this country was 1882's Chinese Exclusion Act that actually had an impact on my family history. When people say, well, my family is immigrants, but we did it legally, well, yeah, but if you came here before 1882, we didn't really have laws to try to bend our immigration policy in order to influence the racial makeup of the immigrants. We had started doing that in 1882 in a wave of hysteria about immigration from China, and really ever since then, less so after the Civil Rights era, but ever since then, immigration policy has been primarily focused on having influence over the racial demographics of this country and, of course, of the immigrants who come to this country. And there really has been no other sensible purpose designed into our laws, and we're trying to change that this year because I think we're becoming a country where the economic viability of our nation is more important than the racial makeup. And so maybe we'll have to take a second look at the way our immigration laws are written and applied. So with that, I wanted to introduce a real live actual immigrant, Annabelle Park. Annabelle, how are you feeling about the new tide for immigration reform?
Hey, everyone. Well, of course, it's encouraging that this is probably a really big opportunity, historic opportunity, to pass comprehensive immigration reform. You know, of course, there'll be lots of details that we're going to work out, but there definitely is momentum. I know that there's going to be some sort of a split between the House and the Senate, but I know that there's just too much passion and advocacy that's kind of created the groundwork for this, that's been building up since 2007 when our last real attempt at immigration reform failed. So it's been, you know, fascinating to kind of document part of this and to try to engage in the debate and to just as a citizen, you know, really be challenged to think about really big questions, because in some ways, immigration reform issue more than maybe any other issue, you know, asks us to think about what it means to be an American. What does that mean? And what does it mean for us to give 11 million people pathway to legalization or, you know, or even citizenship? And so I guess that's one reason, you know, being a philosophy student, I think have been very fascinated by this debate is it does get at, or it forces us to really ask these big questions. And so, you know, of course, you know, race has always been part of the debate, said explicitly or unsaid. And I think that it is something that, you know, we do need to address, that, you know, race has been part of the evolution of immigration policy in our country. And that right now, you know, I've received emails even as late as yesterday after we sent out a notice about this town hall from someone who said, you know, he doesn't want his children in a school that's predominantly Mexican. And he was writing from Los Angeles. I don't know if he's, you know, calling in today, but I would love to, you know, talk to him more about, you know, what exactly he means by that, because that's really all he said. I don't want my children in school with Mexican children. And so, you know, I think that's definitely something that is difficult for especially politicians to to talk about, but I think that it is something that is part of, you know, the debate about immigration. Is there's just a lot of anxiety about, you know, demographic changes in our country. And so we're, you know, this is Coffee Party Town Hall. We can talk about really anything as long as we're, you know, being respectful and civil. And so if anyone is willing to bring that up, address that, that's, you know, something that makes some people very uncomfortable, but it is part of our history. So, you know, I welcome those questions and opinions. So, Eric, do we? Yes.
Okay, so we're going to try our first caller. I tried to speak to you before the show started, 314 area code. 314 area code. I hope your mute is off now. Can you hear me? And are you with us, 314 area code?
Yeah.
Hey, how's it going? What's your name?
Is that me you're talking to?
Yeah, we got you.
Okay.
You're on.
Okay. Well, I just think that, first of all, I don't understand why every time the conversation about immigration in the U.S. is talked about in this country, that the conditions these people are leaving behind are never talked about. What is it? In other words, how come the question's never asked, why do these people have to come here? Because I would propose that the vast majority of them don't want to come here. They come here because they have to. And as soon as you start opening up that Pandora's box about, well, why do they have to, you're getting into, I think, the central issue. And the reason I say that is because, for example, if you're going to be for people coming into this country, then it seems hypocritical to say one person can come in and another can't. And so just take one country, for example, Mexico. It's got, what, 90 million people or so, close to 100 million? What percentage of those people would come here if you just simply threw open the borders? Because like I say, how can you say one person can come and another can't? So let's be fair about it. Let's let them all in. And let's just have open borders. And so you've got, what percentage of them would choose to come here if they could? I would propose maybe 80%, maybe 20% of Mexicans and say, I got no reason to go there. I'm doing good here. But 80% of the people's population, 60, 70 million people or whatever, coming to the United States, what would that do? I mean,
okay, well, let's look at it a little bit from some empirical evidence that we have. We know that during the years since the financial collapse of 2008, that immigration has slowed tremendously, and that in other times in our history when our economy was booming, that there has been more immigration. And we also know that there's a direct relationship between the need for the really backbreaking labor of picking lettuce and tomatoes in our agricultural industry, that there have been seasonal migrants. Right.
So I'm glad you brought that subject up. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you brought that subject up. And the reason is because when people come here to pick our crops because of this so-called theory, and it may be true, but let's look at it on that aspect too, that Americans don't want to do the work because it's too hard, it doesn't pay, whatever. Okay, so here's the deal. As an American worker, you quite literally can't work in a vegetable patch because it doesn't pay enough. Now, it will pay enough if you're willing to work, or actually to live, like a Mexican immigrant laborer. That is to say, if you're willing to crowd 15 people to a hotel room and live sleeping on the floor and this and that. In other words, so everybody shares the expense of their living. You see where I'm going with this? In other words, the idea that Americans can't do it. You're right.
Is that a policy proposal?
That's not a policy proposal of mine, but what I'm getting at is the idea that, you know, Americans don't do it, or won't do it, or you know, don't want to do it. The reality, you have to look at the economic reality, which is really nothing more than addition and subtraction. In other words, if you're going to live like an American, you can't live like an American and pay what they pay in those fields. So it's, you know what I'm getting at? Unless you're willing to live like they do, and that being the immigrants who come here, and you know, if you don't know this, you should know this. They're either giving a completely substandard housing, or they're packed into a hotel room somewhere, 15 people to a room, like I say, no privacy, no nothing. And that little bit of money they make over and above what it takes to live here gets sent home. What I'm getting at is this. For years and years and years, the agricultural industry has gotten away with paying substandard wages. And you know, and it always goes back to, well, but look at the benefits. Well, yeah, look at the Walmart model, right? The Walmart model is, we save you money, so you know you live cheaper, so don't worry about this cheap goods coming in from sweatshop labor in China. I think in the long run that kills everybody. You can't have a standard of living like we do in an open, no tariff-based economy where they, you know, the Chinese can ship us. And by the way, it's hardly you can hardly call it Chinese. These are displaced American manufacturers that are just in turn shipping their goods back here with no tariff. So it's a win-win situation for the corporations. It's a lose-lose situation for the American citizen.
Okay, so just to answer your initial question, I think that if there were open borders between the United States and Mexico, similar to what you have in the European Union, what we would probably see is that the labor supply and labor demand, the macroeconomic forces would have an impact on the amount of migration there is. People would go where the jobs are, in other words. So is that what you're proposing?
Well, no. All I'm saying is that to counter the argument of those who think we should have much freer, and I don't know what they mean by much freer immigration laws. What I'm saying is it's hypocritical to say, well, let's let all the people that are smart in technology, in other words, the high-tech jobs, let's let anybody who's qualified come in on that sense. No matter how you term it, the point is that there's winners and losers. And the losers are us, the worker, including yourself. I mean, if you're going to go and pay for a college education only to compete against a guy who paid a third for his college education coming from, for example, India, right, and it's a high-tech job, that guy can afford to work for a lot less than you can, even in this country. Why? Because he didn't pay as much for college. He doesn't have the big college bills to pay back. I mean, these are major issues you got to look at. It's not a level playing field. It's not a level playing field. And this is what I was trying to point out earlier with the agricultural worker. I mean, there's millions of people in this country who could go out and pick tomatoes or whatever, but the point is they have to live like the immigrants who come here just to even have anything left over. I mean, forget about having things over and above your expenses to buy, you know, something that you desire, like maybe a night out at a restaurant. You know what I'm saying? You literally would have to live like they do. So what does that mean? First of all, housing. Housing being the biggest single issue cost that most people have on a monthly basis. You would have to live in some sort of a living situation where you're in there with about 10 to 15 other people just to have something left over and above your expenses. And you know, a lot of these people come here and they can't afford cell phones. They can't afford, okay, so get rid of your cell phone and all those extra luxuries that you take for granted. Because to have anything, once again, to have anything left over above your expenses, I mean, come on, man, this is simple math. You would have to live in almost, you know, almost homeless-like conditions. You might as well almost be homeless, live in a tent, you know, put a tarp over your head and call that home. Because that's the reality of what it costs to live here, making the wages that they pay in an agricultural environment. And all I'm saying is that these are things that never get talked about. And this is what kind of makes me mad. These things never get talked about. Now, that's on the subject of inside our borders. Now, take the whole thing and go outside of borders. And once again, like I started, ask what are the conditions that force these people to have to leave their country. I mean, put yourself in their shoes. If you're in Mexico and you've got a drug war going on where everybody's afraid to get shot and everything like that, ask yourself, well, what's this all about? Why a drug war? I mean, there's always been drugs funneling through Mexico to the United States. Why all of a sudden a drug war? Well, I think it requires taking a closer look at Plan Colombia, what's happened in Colombia. Now, that used to be called Plan Colombia. Now they've got the Merida Initiative in Mexico, but it's the same thing. It's a so-called war on drugs. I would propose to you that you look at the NGOs who are working in the you have, and they're going to tell you that's a diversion. Okay?
Okay.
That's a diversion.
Well, we got some other callers
lined
up.
It's not about fighting drugs.
But thank you very much for those insights. Let's see if our 513 caller wants to respond. 513 area code, let us know your name and where you're calling from.
It's Laura from Cincinnati.
Hey, Laura. So, Laura, how do you feel about the prospects of comprehensive immigration reform, the four planks being tighter border restrictions, checks on employers to make sure they're not hiring, H-1B visas, and a pathway to citizenship for the 11 million people estimated who are here without proper documentation?
Well, you know, that's a mouthful. But, you know, here's what it all boils down to me. The laws are written for the rich, not for the poor. So, and we live in a supply and demand economy. We always have, as far as I know. So the more labor there is, the cheaper the pay will be. And as far as this high-tech stuff, to say that somebody who welds has to have a 4-year degree in metallurgy, you know, it's all games that are like totally un-American, because to be American means to be free. It means the land of equal opportunity. And we're not getting equal opportunity like that. And I think it's disgusting and deplorable that people take advantage of other people to that degree. Plus, in most states, there is health laws that say you can't even have more than 2 children in a bedroom. And if it's a boy and a girl, they each have to have their own separate bedroom. So, you know, that's where it really is at. I mean, that's why so many of us believe how important it is to overturn Citizens United. And I've always said, from the first time I ever talked to a lawyer, in this country you get all the justice you can afford. I mean, if we're going to be the land of opportunity, then we have to make it the land of opportunity, not the land of whatever the rich people want.
Okay, and, well, this is one case where I think that the rich people actually do want the same thing as most Americans. It's one of the few cases, actually. Comprehensive immigration reform is very popular among voters. And it's also something that's popular among the business community. One thing that you said, Laura, about how having more workers means that wages are kept low. There are all kinds of things that are being done to keep our wages low and to keep the working class and the middle class from getting ahead. But there's a counter argument to the notion that more workers means lower wages, and that is that when you have a class of workers who are being exploited, as our previous caller pointed out, and who don't have the ability to organize, who don't have the ability to press charges, if just for instance somebody decides not to pay them after they've worked for weeks and months, or if they're hurt on the job. Basically, if there's a underclass of workers that employers can use to maximize their profits, it actually creates a trapdoor beneath the minimum wage. And it keeps all wages lower. And so in, you know, previous decades when comprehensive immigration reform was attempted, the labor unions said, wait a second, we don't want this competition. But they've since recognized that what we have with this trapdoor beneath the minimum wage is that it actually holds all wages lower if they can always go to this underclass that has no rights whatsoever to fight back against unfair labor practices.
But you know what? I'm sorry to tell you this. It doesn't matter whether you legally have the right or not. If you can't afford to go to court, if you can't have a lawyer, then it doesn't matter that you have the right. Because I've known plenty of people who have been in front of a judge without a lawyer, and those judges get really angry when you don't know the rules of the court. So,
all right. Well, we got a lot of calls lined up.
Okay.
Laura, are you going to support comprehensive immigration reform? Are you going to ask your representatives in Congress to support it?
You know, I haven't really given it any thought. I don't feel like
okay.
I know.
Okay, well, why don't you listen to the rest of the show and and see how you feel by the end of the show. Maybe we'll come back to you and ask if you have a thought about that issue when we get to the end of the show. We're going to thank you for calling, though, Laura, in Cincinnati. In 254 area code, we're going to our next caller, 254. You're on with Annabelle and Eric. We're talking about immigration reform.
Hi, this is Shane from Texas.
Hey, Shane, how's it going?
Pretty good.
Now, this is Shane Brooks from Waco, Texas. Are you still in Waco, Shane?
Yeah, I'm still in Waco, Central Texas.
Okay, great. And he's one of the original Coffee Party bloggers and leaders of the Coffee Party. He initially had been with the Tea Party. And Shane, why don't you really quickly tell us about, you know, your early experiences with Tea Party in Texas and then coming and organizing with Coffee Party after that.
Okay, sure. Well, when I got involved with the Tea Party, it was several years ago, right when the Tea Party started taking off pretty much, getting off the ground. And I had brought a lot of supporters on with an organization called Tea Party Nation, ran by Judson and his wife, Sherry Phillips. And after organizing with them and getting everything ready, we decided to form the Tea Party Convention. And it became apparent that it started becoming very partisan, a lot of corporate meddling, a lot of establishment meddling started going on. And they decided to have the convention at the Opryland Hotel and Casino in Tennessee. Well, being a person that lost my job, lost my home due to the housing and economic crisis, being one of the quote-unquote middle-class people, I was very upset that here I was in an organization that was supposed to represent the middle class that had suddenly become usurped and very extremely partisan and was holding the convention at a place that was going to cost me, if I wanted to attend, being one of the organizers, almost $700. So I was very upset with that. And then they offered to pay Sarah Palin, I think, $100,000 to come and speak. And that's when it really lit a flame underneath me and I started speaking out. Then I became, you know, according to them, I wasn't a conservative, I was a rhino. And then after that, and I wasn't a rhino, I was a progressive, just like one of them, a communist. And it just got really weirded out there for a while. And then I started reaching out to various organizations, and that's when I came across the Coffee Party in Annabelle Park and started reaching out. And it was one of the very few organizations and leaders that was also reaching out at the time and who I was searching for and to open a dialogue around civility.
So, Shane, hi, it's Annabelle.
Hi, Annabelle.
Hey. So I was very interested to hear kind of your story of how your views on immigration have reformed during that time as well. Do you mind sharing that with us?
Sure. It'll definitely give another side to the story, a different perspective. And it's also been, you know, a change in progress. It's not something that just happened overnight. It's just been an ongoing change for me. And I assume that's going to be true for just about anybody. But anyways, I was working, this is prior to the housing crash and economic crisis when we lost everything, Hurricane Ike, everything happened all at once. I was working down on the coast in Texas around the Houston area in the petrochemical industry. And a company I worked for, I was human resources personnel. I did a lot of the safety training and hiring of people. And being in that line of work, you know, we had a lot of construction contractors, whether it been for scaffold building, insulation, heat treating, just construction, everything you can possibly imagine painting that would go in the petrochemical industry. That's what we did. And therefore, we had a lot of Hispanic workers, probably like an 80 to 20% ratio, actually. And being that I was in charge of the hiring and everything, it was in human resources, I had to do my paperwork, call, you know, references and whatnot, drug tests, do the safety training, and also verify that they were definitely legal to work, whether it been a citizen or a resident, have a resident card or a green card. I would have to check for all that. And a lot of times my duty and what my bosses told me to do was if you came across something fake, yeah, I was trained to spot fake IDs and different identification cards. And so as I came across these, I would just really confiscate them and put them in a shoebox under my desk. And I would have some laughs with my buddies afterwards about all the ones that I confiscated for the day. You know, just thought I was doing my job and never really cared or thought of anything about it. And one day I was doing my job and had confiscated a couple IDs. And one of the gentlemen, I guess he was probably in his 40s, you know, wasn't much older than me. He was probably, at the time, probably about 10 years older than me or so. And it was right before the lunch break when the class let out and I sent people on their way. And one of the guys that I confiscated his ID from, because a lot of our workers that would get trained would come from the valley, rural south, southern Texas. And this gentleman, as I went to the window drinking my coffee and laughing with a friend, a coworker, I saw him outside in a parking lot and tears just started streaming down his face. And he's hugging his wife. And there's a couple kids in the truck. And I watched this guy cry like a little girl, kind of like I'm trying to hold off. I'm doing myself. And, you know, something hit me. That this gentleman was just here to work and take care of his family. And let me tell you one thing. Yeah, there's a lot of mistreated immigrant workers, people that work the fields, don't get the pay they're supposed to. But in this industry, these guys made $17, $19 an hour with not even a high school diploma just because they were hard workers working in a dangerous industry. So they worked shutdowns that we called a turnaround, and they would work 7 to 9 months out of the year at $17 or $19 an hour, sometimes working 7-12, 84 hours a week. So they had tons of overtime. So these guys made a lot more money than I did. You know, some of these guys made $60,000-$70,000 a year. It's not, it wasn't just, you know, it's not all these immigrants here. They're here to support their family, but there are good jobs out there. And that was proof of it. But anyways, this gentleman's out there crying, and it just tore me up watching that. So I went and I grabbed his ID, and I went out there and told him to come back inside, and I just passed him on through the system. I put him to work, and he started crying, and I cried. And he thanked me and hugged me, and he'd come by in the office and see me a couple times, about once every 3 or 4 weeks or so, and thank me for what I did. But at that point, I started relaxing. My standards on, you know, just kind of looking the other way on some people that needed to work. I mean, you had to be a real jerk for me to turn you around and send you back another 9-hour drive without a job from that point on. And even after all that happened, you know, I started changing as a person inside and seeing it for what it really was. And so it was just like a personal growth thing with me. And even then, mm-hmm. I didn't completely think we needed a comprehensive immigration reform, and that wasn't until when I, you know, I guess I discovered the coffee party and started paying attention and doing more research, and I watched Annabelle's documentary 9500 Liberty, and then I think seeing a community torn apart at the fabric of such a bitter division and almost the hatred of the immigrants within the communities. These were people that kept businesses afloat because, contrary to popular belief, they do pay taxes, everyday taxes that we pay, tax on their gasoline, tax on the clothes they buy, tax on the shoes on their feet. I mean, you name it, they pay it. And that also stimulates the economy. And to see that rip apart not only the economy of the community, but the fabric, the neighboring aspect, the community factor, I believe is probably the tipping point for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm glad to hear the story, and I love how you tell the story, because partly you talk about just a completely different recognition of this person who had probably been feeling like, you know, illegal immigrants that seem like completely other to us, and they don't feel like our neighbors or friends. And I think sometimes it is such a subjective human experience to go from thinking they're the other to they're just like me and they're part of our community. And that then suddenly, as soon as you see that kind of, you have that cognitive shift, then the policy changes also happen. So I think this is why Eric and I kind of approach things the way we approach it, using stories and documentaries as a way into thinking about and engaging people on these issues. Because often when you meet people as characters in a film, then you have a different way of seeing them, and instead of seeing them on a piece of paper referred to as undocumented or illegal or however we describe them, but when you see them with their children in a film, it's a different, it just becomes a different thing. It transcends the politics. And I think often that is the thing that unlocks something that paralyzes us at the policy level, is because we talk about it in abstract and we take away the humanity of the situation. I think that one of the things that Eric and I learned doing 95 Minute Liberty was really how integrated immigrants are, legal and illegal, how integrated they are into our economy. And when you try to separate and segregate the ones who are undocumented and say, we're going to punish them and detain them, deport them, it actually hurts the whole economy. And it's not just, when I say the economy, I don't mean just that part of the issue. I mean, when the economy hurts, then our tax revenues shrink and everything starts to basically deteriorate. And so I think that's one of the things that I learned, is just this is why it's so important to approach this issue in a holistic way, instead of saying, okay, it's about them doing something wrong and we have to punish them and that's the only thing that matters. And that very kind of flat way of thinking about this gets us into trouble. It ends up hurting all of us. I guess that's one of the takeaways for me from having been, documenting this and reading about it and thinking about it, talking to lots of people about it, is I really want people to understand how immigration is not just about the plight of the poor immigrants or about people committing crime, crossing the border in the dark and coming here, sneaking across the border, but it's really the America that we have right now includes many people who have labored for us to have our homes. You know, people who clean our buildings. All those people are part of our society. Not just because they provide service, but they are also consumers, and they are taxpayers.
Exactly.
They create jobs, and they create companies that hire lots of people. And so this is the America that we have created together. And so that's why, I definitely would encourage people to have a more holistic approach to this. And instead of just getting fixated on just one part of it. So that's my lecture. I did want to share one fact with people, that comprehensive immigration reform would result in adding about $1.5 trillion to our economy in the next 10 years. That's a lot of money, and especially when right now people are hurting and our economy is hurting and it's fragile, we really need this infusion. And, I just want to, throw that out there. I got an email from someone who said, why do we only talk about the economy? But it is an important fact of our lives. Okay, so do you want to go on?
Well, Shane, I just had one more question for you before we let you go. So when you thought about immigration before this incident, and the policies that we have, were you one of those Americans who primarily thought of it as a them versus us issue? Because ultimately it does boil down to, the biggest sticking point right now in Congress is whether these 10 million people, 11 million people, are ever going to be allowed to vote, whether we're ever going to recognize them as citizens just like us. And I think at the heart of that question is, do we really see them as equal, or have they? Is there something about them, either the way they got here or something that's, I don't know, genetic or whatever, that makes them not us, not like us, not really American?
Well, prior to that incident, or I guess the beginning of the awakening for me was I was like that. I was quite xenophobic. I was quite us versus them. I was quite, they're harming America. They're harming America. I was one of those guys. I just started actually researching for myself, reading myself. I mean, we're a nation of immigrants. It wasn't until after well over 100 years after this nation's founding that we started having an immigration policy. I believe it was in the late 1800s, that the Chinese Exclusion Act was what started it all. And it wasn't until, like World War I, that we started kind of toughening up a bit, kind of having a sense of isolationism, I guess. But we're all immigrants. I mean, it's kind of hypocritical how we came to this nation, you know, from the various countries that we came from, and what we did to the natives that were living here. And to turn around and tell everybody, get out, you're harming America, is just, it's insanity. And it's, that's hypocritical. And that's not compassionate. And it's completely contradictory to the history of our nation itself. And to have a comprehensive reform, is absolutely needed, because, you know, we can dedicate more resources to, like I disagree with one of your previous callers, that we do need to screen, because we have to bring the best talent or the best quality of citizens. We can't just open the floodgates. I don't think anybody really is just quite for that, because then you have an element, a criminal element that comes in as well. And, you know, so we have to have some kind of comprehensive reform to open the doors for good quality people looking to better their lives and to come in and you know, to live that freedom of being American while being themselves and honoring their own heritage at the same time, which is what America is all about. We have to have some kind of reform to do that. And to not do it is just going to keep hurting us economically, mm-hmm. but it, like we've been talking, it destroys our communities as well. I was one of those guys.
So, Shane, I mean, one question I have for you is, like, you know, how do we convince more people who can't thought the way you used to think? How do we convince more of them to have that transformation or epiphany or change of mind? Like, what do you think is the best way to reach out to them?
It's just to keep being honest and giving the other perspective, keeping the open civil dialogue. But I think ultimately it's going to come from a personal revelation, a personal experience, whether it be with themselves or somebody they know. It took a lot for me on my journey. I know that. It took that incident and then, you know, later on losing my job, losing my house, losing everything and becoming myself dependent on welfare for a time. To really open my eyes and to become active and to research and to just grow into a compassionate person. You know, I really don't know what it's going to take. I think civil dialogue is the first key, and a second key is just going to come from just a personal moment for each of us.
Mm-hmm. Well, Shane, if you can stay, can you stay on with us a little bit? Because we're going to go to some other callers, but I might want to see what you have to say about what they have to say.
Sure.
Okay, cool. All right, thank you so much, Shane in Waco, Texas, one of the original Coffee Party bloggers and leaders. We got 620 area code 727 and 954. The number to call in if you want to join in the conversation is 646-929-2495. 620 area code, let us know your name, where you're calling from,
okay.
What's on your mind.
Okay, I'm Jack Golding. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we hear you just fine, Jack. Go ahead.
And Jack Golding. And I'm thinking about a lot of that stuff. I have some ideas. not just the border. I think the borders are pretty secure the way I hear from television about Obama securing the borders. And I also the experience of the last caller, I'm for no labels. Hate the word term rhino or communist or socialist or whatever. Okay. And people should avoid those sweatshops. Avoid the sweatshops. Now, these sweatshops should be made to pay minimum wage at least, and that way will discourage a lot of the less desirable persons from coming into
Well, Jack, you know, a lot of people would argue that if we actually had a minimum wage that was enforced in the agricultural industry, for instance, the farming giants would keep their profits the same by passing along the cost to the consumers. Would you be willing to pay more for your lunch in order for these undocumented immigrants and therefore other laborers in America to be paid living wages?
Well, I'm thinking about the sweatshops, like say in Los Angeles or Chicago. They exploit these types of people they don't know. And I would say too it's another thing they could join gangs. Now you got to be very careful who you get through the border.
Right. Smuggling, so you agree with Shane from you agree with Shane from Texas that, and I'm not sure if our first caller was actually suggesting opening borders as his policy. I think maybe he was saying that as a devil's advocate or to kind of be facetious. But Jack from Kansas, thank you for calling in with those two important points. We're going to go next to 727 area code. You are on the air now with Annabelle and Eric. It's an immigration virtual town hall. Let us know your name and where you're calling from. What's on your mind?
Hi, this is John Rockwell from Palm Harbor.
Hey, John.
Hey. Actually, I should kind of thank you guys for taking a civil tone and being very diplomatic and how you approach a lot of the issues and stuff. But it's nice to see that for change. I hadn't really given a lot of thought about the immigration issue because I've been doing a lot more thinking about jobs and stuff like that. But after watching a little video there prior to this phone call, and kind of getting a kick out of the lady who said, well, you know, if you really want to know what we're talking about, this Manassas meeting, go ask so-and-so because he knows much more about it. And I'm thinking, well, you're supporting him. Don't you know what you're supporting? But in any case, okay, so I gave some thoughts to the immigration thing here. A real quick pathways to citizenship. I can think of three ways I'd support that, okay? One, and giving the people who want to come in, undocumented immigrants, a choice, okay? One is you could participate in building a high-speed trail route between, well, actually on the East Coast, the West Coast, and between Chicago and Houston, okay? That would benefit us, especially when it comes to, as a whole country, when it comes to droughts lowering the Mississippi so barge traffic can't travel down it. If you build both passenger, I'm talking about passenger high-speed rail and freight high-speed rail, okay? In the event of hurricanes in the south, it gives you a way to get people out of the south faster, okay? I'm thinking there could be host towns and host cities along the way that were willing to accept the families of the people who are going to work on these railways, right? In return, these host cities would be supplied by the second choice given to these undocumented aliens, or immigrants, excuse me, which would be the farm workers, okay, the migrant farm workers. First, I would house them in the FEMA trailers that go get sit unused until disaster. We might as well use them, give them good housing, right? And tell any farmer or corporate farming company that if you want to use these workers, fine, you pay them a minimum wage and 1% of your crop. And 1% of that crop goes to those host cities. And you have to be a resident of the host cities in order to get that free food or whatever, right? So the host cities see a benefit then to the people living there. And you have a second pathway to citizenship. And all three of the pathways I'm going to talk about would require you to know English by the end of your when you're applying to become a citizen. And you'd have to pass whatever the typical citizenship test is, which probably most Americans couldn't pass themselves. But in any case, the third path would be to create an anti-crime force, basically. They would go after the gangs like the Crips, the Bloods, stuff like that. So you could, and those, the families, the people who took that pathway to citizenship would have to be moved to this country and put up in a safe city for obvious reasons, right? So you get three pathways for people who become citizens.
Hold on for 1 second. John, first of all, what part of the country are you calling from?
I'm calling from Palm Harbor, Florida.
Okay, great. So you hadn't thought about this until today, and you came up with all that?
Yeah, because I'm kind of a divergent thinker. I spend a lot of my time just thinking of solutions to problems. As a matter of fact, I got a web page with like just 300 ideas. That, as you know, people come up with ideas and think, oh, I should have written that down. Well, I created a web page, so I just go ahead and write them down as I'm thinking of them and stuff.
Okay. Well, let me respond real quick. I mean, first of all, you know, these are not people who are waiting outside of our country to come in and that we can make a deal with them. Okay, these are the fields that we want you to work in. These are the, not fields, pun not intended. These are the trades we want you to work in. They're already integrated into our economy in so many ways that if you had 300 lists, you know, if you had a list of 300 ways for them to be integrated in our economy, it wouldn't be enough. So I don't know if we... I don't know if we can dig down to special deals for certain sectors other than we have a tremendous need for agricultural workers, and then we also have a tremendous need for engineers who have computer science backgrounds. Those things are holding our economy back. And, you know, I have an analogy that I've been talking about with the gun issue is that too often people think of the gun issue in terms of, well, how do I decrease the chances that I personally will be in a gun massacre? And, well, okay, we have to do this and have this huge fight with, you know, the NRA and other, you know, gun enthusiasts over, you know, reducing my chance from 1% to 0.5%. And I'm still most likely not going to be in a gun massacre, so why bother? And that's not the way that we should be thinking about it, because in a country of 320 million people, if you reduce the chance of gun massacre by 0.5%, you're talking about thousands of lives every year. So the same thing is true with economics, right? So I think too many people think about immigration in terms of, well, you know, I worked hard, I did it the right way, or I paid this amount for my education, and some guy from India is going to pay less, and he's going to have an advantage over me. And they think about it just in terms of your personal attempt to get ahead versus somebody else's personal attempt to get ahead, and maybe there's a bit of a racial screen, like a film on there and through which we see things. But I don't think that's the way to think of immigration. We're talking about a national policy that's going to affect our national economy, and it's going to affect the way in which we're able to compete with the economies of other nations, which, you know, by the way, they also have a shortage of labor. Their economies also are being held back by the fact that they have way too many people who are retiring from the workforce because of the baby boom generation and way too few people who are working to generate the economic might and the tax dollars to take care of those elders who are now on social service programs. So the whole world, especially the world, I mean, not the whole world, But those developed countries who were involved in World War II are all faced with this demographic reality that we need an infusion of labor right now. And the United States has to compete, and we do have an advantage. But if we had gone the other way, it looks like we're going to go the right way. But if we'd gone the wrong way and closed our borders and said we don't want economic growth, not if it comes at the cost of shifting demographics, well, then other countries would have benefited from that labor, and not us. And so the question is much broader in terms of what happens to our economy as a whole if suddenly we figure out how to adjust our immigration laws so that the demands of a growing economy can be met by people who are legally present, not by, as what we've been doing the last 20, 30 years, by people who are here undocumented. Now, that means that they won't be able to be exploited in the same way. So, therefore, they'll have to be paid a living wage. Therefore, other people will be paid a living wage. Therefore, the big corporations aren't going to be able to profit in the same way that they have. How's that going to affect our economy? Like, we have to think about it in these broader terms. So,
well, I actually have several responses to that. Okay. One is I am in the IT field. Okay, and I'm a contractor and I'm successful in it. And I have worked at several companies where people have come in with from India with H-1B visas and stuff. And I have no personal problems at all with anybody that come from China or come from all over the world. But they are, in a lot of cases, taking jobs in the niche programming area that I work in from people who already know how to program in that those languages. So they are not filling critical needs, okay? They are replacing actual citizens who could take care of those needs. There are a lot of critical needs jobs that are not, there are no American citizens qualified to fill, who legitimately, we should let those people from wherever they, whoever has a talent, come in and take those jobs, right? If we can't train Americans to do it. As far as the profit scenario, as far as, you know, increasing the price of the paying them a living wage for the migrants and stuff like that, and then having the price increase passed on to us, I've always thought the unions in the beginning took the right track, but they got off track about 10, 15 years ago, okay? Instead of going on strike for higher wages, right, which just get passed on to us then, they should go on strike for a decrease in the cost of the price of their product, which basically cuts into the margins that these big corporations are making. All right. So then we would all support that. I mean, it would lower the cost of living. Well, it wouldn't lower it. It would just keep more or less equal, right? We wouldn't get a lot of inflation because of it. And I agree also that a lot of the people who are already here who are undocumented would not jump over and say, okay, I'm going to start building a railroad. Okay. There has to be a way for them to, in their current positions, become legal citizens. And I agree with Shane. It takes personal exposure. Actually, 30 years ago, when I was living in California, I was actually hanging around with some people who were bringing in illegal aliens, okay? And once you become friends with, you know, whatever group it is, and you have that personal exposure, a lot of that xenophobia, racism, it all goes away once you know them. Which isn't to say if you ran into another group of the exact same ethnic group but didn't know anybody yet, that the xenophobia wouldn't kick back in again, because it does. I've experienced that too.
Well, you know, I don't think we need to demonize people who prefer to be among those who, with, you know, with whom they're familiar. I mean, it's a universal thing, and, you know, I think there are a lot of people. My family is Chinese on one side and white on the other side. I can tell you that Asian people are just as likely to prefer to be with people, you know, that they're familiar with and all that. And so, you know, in this country, we have a history of oppression of minorities by Caucasian people, but I don't think we need to, at this point in our history, I don't think we need to try to apply that in a way that says white people are more likely to be prejudiced. So I just want to preface
this. I don't think so.
Yeah.
I agree with that, too. And actually, a lot of people don't realize it, but as of the last year or two, Asians are the fastest-growing immigrant group in the United States, which kind of skews a lot of people's thinking. But you're right. And it actually was a survival trait, evolutionary-wise, back in the day of tribes and stuff. If you didn't belong to the tribe, you were likely to be killed. You know, the other tribe was your enemy, right? So it served you well to stick with your tribe.
Right. My dad told me this. He's like, the longer it takes you to recognize that that person's not your tribe, the less time you're going to have to react when the spear comes. So we learn those instincts. And thanks for your call, John. It is John, right?
Yes, it is. Huh?
Okay. Thank you very much for your call. I mean, this is an interesting thing is that, you know, Shane's story about, you know, confiscating this man's ID, it was his only chance to be able to feed his family, right? Putting it in that shoebox, and then happening to look out the window when he broke the news to his wife and had his children look through the window and see their parents despairing in that way, suddenly brought him into a sense of shared humanity with this family. And then he ended up forming a friendship with this man over the years because he gave him a break, okay? Now, I asked Shane to come and tell that story, not because I think that we need to, well, of course, I want us all to have that sense of shared humanity, but it's not because we need to give them a break. That's not why we need Conference of Immigration Reform. And I don't know if you've seen the whole movie, John, 9500 Liberty, you referenced it at the beginning of your call, but what we learned in that story was that to make the argument for, in this case, you know, not having a law that requires the police to check people's immigration status based on their appearance rather than their conduct, similar to the Arizona law. But in any case, when you make the immigration argument based on, well, let's have more compassion for people and then give them a break, well, it's understandable, especially in tough economic times, why people who, yes, have this natural genetic proclivity to look out for their own kind as they perceive it before others are going to say, the heck with that, I don't want to give them a break. Well, that's not why I wanted Shane to share that story, because I think that most Americans are beginning to understand that immigration and economics are tied together, and having enough engineers to have a booming economic, you know, juggernaut of an economy to have the kind of startup communities and the kind of entrepreneurs that we need. You know, all the statistics show that immigrants are actually more likely to be your boss than your employee. They're more likely to start companies. Immigrants come here with an entrepreneurial spirit that is really at the heart of why this country has been successful. So it's not to give them a break, it's to give us a break. It's to allow our economy to grow at the strength and the speed that we need it to grow to solve all the many problems that we're faced with. And so we have to get past that sort of tribal instinct to say it's them versus us, and we need to protect what we have and keep them from getting what they have and all that stuff. And we want people to get past that tribalistic instinct, natural instinct, but it's holding us back. It's holding our country back because immigration is an economic boom. Immigration is why we are the strongest economy in the world. It's not been holding us back. What holds us back is the perception that someone isn't as able to contribute to the society because they come from a different country or speak a different language. So thank you very much for that call. We're going to go to 954 and then 404. 954, you are on an immigration virtual town hall with Annabelle and Eric Liss. Know your name, where you're calling from, what's on your mind?
Hi, my name is Mark Pilling. I'm in Fort Lauderdale,
hey,
Florida. A lot of these discussions I find end up usually being very emotional discussions. And, you know, I've heard Shane say, we got to be compassionate three times. You just used an argument about the economics, that we need immigrants here, they create businesses, they'll put us to work. But I don't hear cold hard facts. And when you get to issues like this, there's a couple things that I think you have to do. Number one, you have to introduce facts. Number two, you have to look at the United States Constitution, and you have to determine what is the constitutional solution for the issue. Would you agree or disagree with those two things, that you need facts and you need to know what the constitutional solution is? Because so far in the conversation, that has not been presented. So let me just ask you if you agree that I can introduce some facts and the constitutional solution to this issue. Do you think those two things are important?
Well, certainly facts are interesting when it comes to race and immigration. In this country, we have a history of making up facts to support policies rather than using facts to support policies. And so I definitely am interested to hear what you have to say. But if you want me to give you a factual basis for why immigrants are a boon to economies, just here are some statistics. Immigrants are 28% of all the new businesses that were created in 2011, but that's despite being only 12.9% of our population. So, you know, I'm getting this from, I'm going to put it into the chat room in a second. It's called New American Economy. So I'll put it in the chat room in a second, but there definitely, I mean, we could go into statistics and stuff, but I think there's a general consensus that immigration has been a boon to our economy over the years. It's the one advantage that we've had. I mean, it was the Pilgrims and the Native Americans who were the only ones who were innovating and creating jobs in America. I don't think we'd be ahead.
Okay, well, let me just introduce a couple things to you. There's 195 nations in the world. The United States immigrates more than all of them combined. We immigrate over 1 million legal immigrants per year. Okay, 1 million. Okay, so when it comes to compassion needs to be taken out of the conversation, because the United States is compassionate times 195 countries. Okay, number one. Number two, when we're talking about immigration reform, the words are really synonymous with amnesty. And if you just look at any time there's been immigration reform throughout our history, that is generally what happened. And if you understand our immigration policies in the last 100 years, you would understand that immigrants, the legal immigrants, saw the opportunity that they had here in our country. They respectfully abided by the laws to get into the country, and then they took the opportunity and ran with it, a little bit like what you discussed earlier, creating businesses and bringing, you know, ideas here to America. Now, when we're talking about 11 to 20 million illegal residents, the Constitution of the United States says, which I never hear introduced in these conversations, but I'm going to introduce it to you, in Article 4, Section 4, the United States Constitution, it says that the federal government shall provide a republic form of government, not a democracy, a republic form of government, and defend the states and protect the states against invasion. Now, we got 10 to 20 million illegal invaders. Now, for some of you that are listening, I would highly recommend, there's a short film called Constitution C, Amnesty No, that
okay,
gives
hold
you
on
some
one
of
second.
These facts. And excuse me?
If you go into the chat room, you can put the website in there so we don't have to spend the time reading it. You know, Shane mentioned the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, and I did mention I was going to talk about, you know, my own family history just a little bit. And then we actually had John talking about building high-speed rail, coincidentally, and a lot of Chinese immigrants in the 1800s did build railroads. So when the Constitution was written, we actually didn't have any kind of naturalization or immigration process. When the Constitution was written, there were the Native Americans, there were the slaves, and then there were the German, English, you know, Dutch settlers. And so there wasn't really a question. I mean, anyone who could get there, and there wasn't, you know, any right way or wrong way. Immigration was basically you come there, and if you have to fight against the Native Americans, you do. But, you know, you're an American once you get there. Now, in 1882, they passed the Chinese Exclusion Act because it was our first immigration law. And so on one day, you know, these Chinese immigrants who had built the railroad and were now starting to settle into these slums we call Chinatown, they were legal immigrants. And then the next day, they were illegal invaders based on the law that was created. So if you want to narrow it down to who's the invader, who's illegal and all that stuff, it's as simple as, well, how do we choose to define them according to our laws? And so it's not really about how you feel about people who come from different countries, right? It's pretty soon it's going to be these people have legal status. So you're not going to be able to say they're illegal, they're not illegal, that sort of thing. They're going to have legal status soon. And the real question, really the only difference between what Congress wants to do and what the president wants to do, is whether they're going to be allowed to vote. That's the only real question. So, I mean, let me ask you, let's narrow it down to where we really have I think as a people we're going to have to come to decide. There's one option that we're going to have people as permanent second-class citizens who are never allowed to vote, never allowed to become legal citizens, and they do that either by agreeing ahead of time that they'll never be citizens, or they do it by saying, well, you can be citizens as soon as the border is 100% secure, and of course that could never happen. Or we end up having an actual path to citizenship, and this is what the president wants, where these people, you know, after going to the back of the line and going through a process that's hopefully improved and expedited, they eventually will become citizens. So let me ask you, Mark, what would be your preference there?
Well, let me ask you. There's 195 nations in the world. Most of them have very stringent immigration laws, including Mexico. So what you're saying is that, okay, these people have broken our laws. They've disrespected the millions of people that are respectfully waiting in line and going through the proper immigration and lawful immigration process. And we got to throw our hands up and just do whatever they ask us to do. And that's really not the case. Something that you may want to do some research on, and again, it's in the film Constitution See, Amnesty No, a large portion of illegals do house a percentage of our prison systems and are part of the crime that we do see in the lower southern states. The only thing I want to just end up on, and I want you to really concentrate on, your listeners to concentrate on, is that this is a much deeper issue than just the surface, let's see what we're going to do with these people. One of our past leaders said, a nation without borders is not a nation. Think about that. Our world and our country is heading towards world government. You have the United Nations, you have the United Nations Peacekeeping Force, which is their military force. You have the World Bank in Basel, Switzerland. You have the International Monetary Fund. All of a sudden, many nations' currencies and are collapsing. Our federal government has driven us $16 trillion in debt, really in our lifetime. I don't know if you're aware of this, but
okay.
In 1980...
Well, we're getting a little bit off topic.
I'm just trying to bring you and your listeners to understand that there is a much deeper side of this issue. It's not just, hey, we got 11 million people. It's the fact that the people, the oligarch, the men behind the scenes, the financiers, the industrialists that are running our puppet politicians are basically trying to drive us to world government. And that means nations without borders. Okay, so if you get a chance,
okay,
watch the movie Money Masters.
Okay.
Watch the movie
Money Masters
and
Constitution See, Immigration No. Thank you, Mark. Mark, if you want to put that in the chat room so people can I'm not sure they'll know how to spell C, although it is S-I, but thank you for that call. I'm going to just give Shane a chance to respond. Hold on there, Shane. We're going to get 404 area code in there first, but since Mark did reference your call for compassion, Shane, I wanted to give you a chance to respond to him. Let's get 404's input, and then we'll go back to Shane. 404, you are on the air with Annabelle and Eric in Immigration Virtual Town Hall. Tell us your name, where you're calling from, and what's on your mind.
Good afternoon, Robert Rodrigo in Atlanta. Appreciate you doing the show, very important subject. I'd like to make some responses to some of the comments and then also make some personal observations that I've experienced, especially over the last decade. The last caller made some points that I'd like to directly respond to. One is he mentioned about people committing crimes and how they're integrating into our into our prison system. My comment to that is anybody that commits a crime that goes to prison that's an illegal immigrant gets shipped out of the country. It does cost us some money, but they get shipped out of the country. It doesn't matter where they're from. That's how the system works. So in my opinion, that aspect of this immigration issue is irrelevant because those safeguards are already in place. And it's no different than if anybody who is a citizen commits crime to go to jail. As far as the invasion aspect of it, certainly illegal immigration is not an invasion. The founders were thinking solely about military situations there, and one could argue, I suppose, if it's an extreme view that the integration of the illegal immigrants is part of some kind of military move or clandestine move, I suppose. But you'd have to be really extreme, and you'd have to somehow prove that. I don't believe that that's the case. So again, I don't think that has anything to do with the situation. As far as the economy is concerned, I believe you're absolutely right in how it's integrated, involved. And talking about the minimum wage aspect of it, well, even regardless of the illegal immigrant issue or those people in our society, the minimum wage absolutely needs to go up. And I don't really care what the personal have to spend more money on lunches is going to happen. I mean, to me, that's another issue when it comes to profit issues. But we're talking about people, the rates right now of the minimum wage, if you just do the math, and you do 40 hours a week times 52 weeks, we're talking about a wage that is below the poverty line. So the result of that is, when you talk about what's going to come out of our pocket, everybody, is now we're talking about having to spend money on the safety net that people will need because they're not making enough money. So it's, to me, let's put them above the poverty line and lower our demand, our necessity of the safety net. So now, and then they go to personal experience with the illegal immigrants. I said many times on these shows that I'm an owner of a commercial construction company in the Southeast. And prior to the E-Verify process the need to follow the law, the requirement to follow the law, I, of course, was one of many people who had people who were not documented working for me along with people who were. Now, I'll tell you some things about that. And these things are facts. These are not opinions. These are observations. These happen, and you can check with people who are undocumented if they have a job. When I pay anybody, it's on the books. And back then, when I paid anybody, it was on the books. Now, normally what happens is if undocumented workers will go get a job, they will have some kind of an ID, and what will happen is that it will not get e-verified. Now, when you e-verify somebody, you run them through a system. You have an account. You run it through the system. And the only thing that happens is it will come back and say that the name does not match either the license or the resident card that they have with the Social Security number. And I can tell you that 50% of the time it's because the names are not either recorded right by the Social Security Department or people write their names different or whatever and usually can work it out. But the other 50% of the time, all they do is send you documents to give the person so they can fill out to resolve the issue. But it does not tell you that you cannot employ these people. So now you have another great gray area, and anybody can check this out. All you have to do is go to the Homeland Security website, and you can register for an E-Verify. If you have a tax ID number, you're supposed to have a E-Verify account anyway. So you can go and do all this, and you can see, I'm telling you, absolute gospel, that this is the way this happens. Now, the other thing that happens, that has happened over the years with non-documented workers, is they get a check, they're paying their taxes, but they're not filing income tax returns to get any taxes back because they can't, because they don't have a legal Social Security number to go in it. So they have just given the money to the United States government without even thinking about getting any back. And then there are other little scenarios that they do. Some of them will go get tax ID numbers and then get 1099, and they will file taxes, and they won't have a Social Security number, and they'll do it just like anybody else. They do work for wages. In the construction business, like the gentleman said earlier, I think it was Shane that was talking about the wages that people make. They absolutely make regular wages. And when you go to the aspect of whether or not they're taking jobs from legal citizens, well, there's two sides to that coin. The first side is, well, if you look at it, well, you have this many people out of work and this many people working, and some of these people might not be legal, or they may be legal immigrants, because to me the prejudice is extensive. You have people who are legal who don't go after the jobs themselves. There was a story recently before the election, for example, in the state of Idaho, where a factory out there was begging people to come to work, and people were telling them, we'd rather stay on unemployment. Now, this really happened. Now, everybody knows in our society, like if you drive to a Home Depot or a Lowe's or something like that, or a certain corner of a street, that there are a number of non-documented people, usually, that are out there looking for jobs. And they're doing, you know, usually $10 an hour or whatever they're trying to do to help you out. Now, I'll tell you something. There could be plenty of other people out there doing the same thing if they're out of work looking for work. You've got to have the drive. They seem to have the drive for whatever reason. Now, none of these comments are meant to say I side with one side or the other, but these are things that are happening in our society. And they're absolutely integrated into our economy. There's no way around that. You know, and I believe that the majority of legal and illegal immigrants that are using the safety net are strictly because they're having a hard time getting health insurance any other way, or don't know how to get health insurance any other way, or their employers refuse to get it and they, you know, they're on their own, without a doubt. Now, I have my company now, of course, we don't have any non-documented workers. We only use legal immigrants, or, well, actually, I shouldn't even say it that way. We use citizens, essentially. And I offer all the things I'm supposed to offer, and I do it the way I'm supposed to do it, and I employ anywhere from 40 to 100 people at a time, depending upon how good business is. And all the people that work for me make a good wage. And I can tell you from personal experience that most of the people that are walking through my door are people that are new to this country within the last however many years. They are legal. They have to be for me now. But they are new to this country as opposed to the drive for people who have already been here for all this time. So I sit here on a daily basis and I listen to these arguments about taking jobs and minimum wage and what people are doing, and I'm not getting anywhere because of what I'm seeing in and out of our society on a daily basis. The situation is definitely complicated. And then going back to respond one last thing about what the gentleman said about the way that we're supposed to just accept these people. Well, what the president is proposing, which I do agree with, is that everybody goes to the back of the line, which how else could you do it fairly? To me, you can't do it any other way. That to me, that's common sense. If you're going to keep the people in the economy, and I have two gentlemen that worked for me for about 6 years now, and they both went through the system. They came to work for me as supervisors, as foremen. They came to work for me. They worked hard. They went through the process. They had lawyers. They had to go back to Mexico. Each one of them had to go back to Mexico for 3 months, and then they could come back, and then they were a legal citizen. And I can tell you that the entire time that they were doing this, they were legal. They had papers with them, but you can't e-verify these guys because of the strict way that you have to e-verify. So now I have a gray area where if somebody comes to see me and they have these documents that start this process, I know that they're legal. I know it because I've done the research, but I cannot e-verify that. So technically I'm violating the law. So there's a lot of things that need to be cleaned up. But
okay. Well, Robert, yeah. Let me just ask you a real quick yes or no question. It mm-hmm. seems like the biggest difference between the Republicans in Congress, at least the more mainstream Republicans in Congress, and the president, is whether the people who are here illegally now will ever be granted full citizenship and the right to vote, or if somehow we can rig it so that either by throwing red tape in the way, or we actually just agree from the very beginning that they will be forever second-class citizens. What would be your preference?
My preference is that the process is the same for everybody regardless. If they're going to come out of there, they need to go to the back of the line and go through the process. And if they do that, when they do that, they're just like anybody else. You know, we are a unique country. You know, we're talking about we're the only country that does this, we're the only country that does that. Well, you know, we're the only country that has a constitution that's even written the way ours is, first of all. We're the only country that has the economy the way it is, first of all. You know, and I also, one last thing I'll point out about this immigration issue. To me, And it, to me, what we have is we have two immigration issues. We have an immigration policy that has to work, but the elephant in the room is that what we're really talking about here is a Mexican policy, because those are the people that we're talking about. We're not talking about the same situation with other people that come from the people that come from other countries. We're talking about the people that are coming from Mexico. That's really what's going on here. So we have the Mexican population, and then we have the other immigration situation where people come over from other places because they're on our border. The majority of these millions of people that are here are from Mexico, nowhere else. You know, some of them maybe from Central America, et cetera, but that's what we're talking about here. And if anybody goes through the process legally, then they're a citizen, in my book.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to go to Shane in a second. Thank you for all of those insights, Robert. There are a lot of Asian Americans who are caught in the immigration system right now, who have family members that they can't bring here because, you know, we have this interesting quota system that was the compromise from 1965, but they thought it was progressive at the time. In fact, many of the anti-immigrant forces that are at play today are still angry about 1965 because of the way it's impacted the white majority. But it could have impacted the white majority a lot more. But what they did is they said no single country can have more than 17% of the immigrants that are granted status in a year. And so it's interesting how that ends up applying to this country, Mexico. Much of our land was once part of the land of Mexico. And let's just be honest with ourselves here. Who are the Mexicans? Well, they're Native Americans who were conquered by a different country. They were Native Americans who were conquered by Spain instead of England. And so people who live in Texas and Arizona and people who live just south of Texas and Arizona, well, they're basically all the same people. They're the Native Americans who were conquered by a different country. And so I don't know, you know, there's this funny phrase, how did our oil get under their land when we talk about the Middle East? Well, you know, what we have here basically is how did these Native people get on our land? Well, they were here first. So, you know, it's just, I don't know if compassion is the word. You know, I'm going to go to Shane now so he can address that, because there was someone who, you know, I think it was Mark who called and he was upset that was even part of the conversation, because Mark points out this country already has the highest standard for respect for minorities. We already let in a lot of people, and I think his attitude is that when we let immigrants in, we're doing them a favor as opposed to they're doing us a favor. But Shane, let me bring you back in. Is it simply a matter of compassion to you why you ended up changing your position on immigration?
No, that's just one element of the complexity of my growth, I guess, as a person. It's certainly an important element at that, but no, the economic element, just the ability to see another man standing in front of you that is just like you, has a wife, has kids, has responsibilities, has a duty to his family, wants to take care of his family, as opposed to seeing a Mexican. You know what I mean? There is just a bit of you know, I guess closet racism on my part. You know, growing up in Texas my entire life, I never viewed myself as a racist, but I guess obviously there was some elements within me that suggested otherwise. But no, I think the economic impact and just the ability to recognize that, you know, these are people, they're illegal immigrants by law. And that's it. As you mentioned, that Congress came in and the next day certain class of citizens were suddenly illegal immigrants. They add to our economy. They add to our communities. They create jobs. You know, we don't just have the agricultural need, and I agree with many observations that Robert had about the Verify system. It completely sucks. It's completely incompetent, in my opinion. But, you know, these guys that would work on our crews, let me tell you something. They would, on Thursday was payday, okay? The white guys, you know, my brethren, the Caucasians who were on a cruise, would get their paychecks on Thursday. Everybody got their paychecks on Thursday. It was the Hispanic workers that showed up on Friday Well, hangover or not, they were ready to go to work. They were ready to earn their pay. And that's why we had such a high percentage of Hispanics on our crews, because these guys knew they had a job and knew they had a responsibility to their crewmates to show up for that job. And they did that, and they earned their way. You know, a lot of the Caucasians didn't. A lot of the people that walked through our doors were Hispanic or immigrants, new to the people that were new to the country, people that had a, you know, it's all who you know in a petrochemical industry. A lot of these guys drove from the valley because their supervisor already had a job waiting on them as soon as they, you know, passed processing and the paperwork and everything, and they might have been related or had cousins. And you know, this notion that these people, you know, bunch together in houses because they can't afford to, you know, yeah, that's true for some, but man, let me tell you, there's a lot, and this is a cultural thing. They are very family-oriented culture, and a lot of them live that way because that's in their culture to do so, plus they can minimize their bills between one another and have more to take back home. And as Robert stated, there's a lot of people that, you know, they're paying their taxes on a payroll, but they're not getting any back from the government because they're simply just not legal to do so. But, you know, they're the ones that have the drive to come through and perform a certain work that many in our society don't. And just to pigeonhole them like that is just completely wrong. I believe it's ignorant. And let me tell you, it's not just the fruits and veggies you see on your table that are made by immigrants in this nation and many illegal immigrants. But look around in your room right now and look at all the plastics. Look at the fuel in your car and the oil. Let me tell you something. 80% of people that work in a petrochemical industry, your stuff is made. Plastic, your table, everything that you see is pretty much made by immigrants in this country. They built America, and that's a fact.
Thanks, Jane. Wonderful. Yeah, that's pretty much how I feel as well. I want to go back to, you know, something that I said earlier. And this is kind of a response to Mark, although, you know, I would love to have a long, sustained conversation with Mark when we don't have more callers waiting. But I do feel like there are two different visions for America. I mean, I think there are facts, empirical facts, and there are different sorts of facts we could consider. You know, one is economic. A lot of people now are making purely economic arguments in favor of immigration reform, saying it would help our economy, fix our economy. And there are people who point to the condition of workers and lots of other facts that are considered maybe more social than economic. Or moral arguments. People make moral arguments about, and I guess that was your what you did, Shane, is to me what I liked about it is that you kind of tied things together into a certain vision of America that I agree with, which is that you know, we have to look at our history and give credit where credit is due. Is that, you know, we really owe a lot to immigrants, not just immigrants of the past, but immigrants today that help create our nation and help build our economy. And that, you know, I think there are good arguments to be made about what is our immigration policy going forward that I think is different from what do we do about the immigrants who are here now who are undocumented. And so I think there are definitely tough questions to ask, a lot of empirical questions to ask about, okay, you know, how do we regulate the flow of immigrants going forward? What is the best, fairest way to do that? But I think the question that is before us right now is about what to do about the immigrants who are here right now. How do we treat them? Are we going to continue to be punishing and restrictionist, or are we going to absorb them into our country in more ways than one, not just benefiting from their labor, but to absorb them, integrate them, acknowledge them as fellow Americans, whether or not they have citizenship status or not. And so I think, you know, that to me is going to help create our national identities. Like, who, you know, are we, what are our values? What do we really value? What is our history? And, you know, what kind of America do we want? And I hope that you know, we can have this conversation in a way that, I hope, respects not just, the fact that, you know, they contributed to us, contributed to our economy, but that, I mean, it's an attitude, you know. I think immigrants, I'm definitely thinking about my own situation, my family as well, is that I think, you know, as immigrants, you know, I feel like one thing that we have contributed, and I think I see other immigrant families and immigrants contributing, is that we really do appreciate being here. And we, I think, want to add something to this country. We want to, there's a great deal of diversity that comes with immigration and innovation that helps define America. You know, if America is not innovative, I don't know what we are. And without an infusion of immigrants, I just don't think it would be America anymore. And so it's an attitudinal, cultural thing that I think we should also consider in the debate. And, you know, I mean, to Mark's point, I do sympathize with Yaki's point of view that there's a certain amount of anger, and that the people who you know, came here without proper going through the proper channels, like they shouldn't somehow be rewarded for what they did. I mean, I understand it. I do, because my family did come here legally. We did go through the proper channels and so on. So I do understand it, but I mean, the fact is, this is where we are. You know, we have tacitly, agreed to this. Our companies, our institutions have more or less, you know, agreed to having illegal immigration for years. And so this is where we are. And so we can't just be angry about where we are. We have to figure out how we're going to problem solve this. So I just want to tell Mark, I'm sympathetic. I'm not, you know, I don't disagree with what he's saying here.
Okay, we're going to go to 518 area code in a second. Let me see if, Shane, is there anything you wanted to say? I know you got, you know, things to do and a family to feed and stuff. But do we need to let you go? Or did you want to say a final thing in response to Annabelle?
No, I do need to go. Just thanks for the opportunity. Let me speak and share a different perspective with the listeners.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your contribution to our virtual town hall, Shane.
Thank you.
All right. So 518 area code, you're in. You're on the air now. Tell us your name and where you're calling from and what's on your mind.
Hello, Eric. This is Joe Pomponio calling out of Albany, New York.
Hey, Joe.
All right. If you can hear me all right. I take a broad scope on immigration reform. And, you know, in response to some of what I've heard today, in particular the, southern border. Now, if you want to look at this in a historical sense, we came here from other countries, okay? The countries were America. There's a north and a south. For hundreds of years, even before there was a United States, there were no borders. Now, I know we have to move forward to now, but this plays a part in what's in the minds of people in South America, Central America. Another thing I'd like to point out, when you're dealing with immigration reform, you're dealing with Asians, Mexicans, and island people. Now, I lived in a Spanish-American area of Manhattan, okay? I came to learn that Hispanic basically dealt with island people. Continental people. They were Hispanics. Island people are Latinos. I've come to understand through research Asians are one third or more of our illegal immigrant problem. The borders that they want to secure, okay, do not cover Canada. They don't cover the West Coast, right? I have issues with that, but I'll leave that for another time. Now, one of our callers had mentioned that, you know, we have a problem coming basically from the South. I would tend to disagree with him. This issue goes back to the 1930s, if you want to go back to the last millennium. It was dealt with by our government. They were given visa programs. Now, in immigration today, which I have to admit, I support, we have 11 million people here now. We're not talking about people coming in. We're talking about dealing with people that are living within our borders. Now, if you can find a fair...
Okay, I guess Joe's sounding like his Skype ran out of power. Are you still there, Joe? Very interesting. Okay. Well, I think I know where he was going there, we do have another caller, so let me go to 319 area code and then see if we get Joe calling back in. 319 area code, you're on a virtual town hall with Annabelle Park and Eric Byler. Let us know your name and where you're calling from and what's on your mind.
Well, my name is Richard Gates, and I'm from Keokuk, Iowa.
Hi. So what can you contribute to our conversation?
Well, I have to add this. You know, we've got all these immigrants, as some people would call them. I would call them squatters. They've broken our laws, and they have trespassed on our land, and they have committed fraud, and not all of them, but a large number, have committed fraud to be able to stay in this country. And in the meantime, our middle-class workers haven't seen pay raises for 20 years. They're still making the same thing they were 20, 30 years ago because we can't elevate our wages because we have this other population that has come in and said, well, okay, we'll work for a lot less. So there's a conflict right there. But are we a country of laws? Or are we a country of appeasement? That has to be my question today.
A country of what was the second choice?
Appeasement.
Well, you know, this has been at the heart of our whole conversation today. And Richard, thanks for bringing that up. I want to, give you a chance to talk to Annabelle in more depth. I'm going to hand the phone to her in just a second. I just want to observe that at the heart of the whole thing is how you respond to the way that you and Annabelle both just kind of phrased the reality here is that people who we can physically identify as different, unless you are a Mexican-American, but people who we can culturally and physically identify as different have... as you said, committed fraud or whatever you want to call it. They've done something that many people can perceive to have hurt our wages or, you just said that the reason why our wages have been held down for the last 30 years is because that's, because of illegal immigrants. I think others might differ with that diagnosis. But we have this class of people, and the question is, how do we feel about them in our gut? Are we angry? Do we want some kind of vengeance? Or is there something more important than that? Is there something more important than how we feel about these people, whether it's negative or positive emotions? Should we be looking at things like the economy or the fiscal solvency of our government? Is that more important to you? So let me ask you to answer that first, and then I'm going to have Annabelle talk to you a little bit more about your feelings that you stated in your first, your opening remarks, but is there anything more important to you in this country than how we treat people that you're angry with?
You know what? I'm not angry with anybody except our government because they fail to enforce our laws. If we had enforced our laws and we had enforced our border security, these people would be at home in Mexico or Korea or wherever, and they would be making a living the best they could. I don't think that coming over here illegally, we are a land of laws. I mean, if we don't respect our own laws, then how can we enforce any kind of border security? How can we protect ourselves from any terrorist threats? There's a lot of things at play in this, and it's not about a hatred or a disparity against any person or people. This is all about what we are as Americans and what we're willing to do to protect our national sovereignty.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what do you think should be done with 11 million people here who are undocumented?
11 people that are here
11
illegally.
Million people.
That are here illegally. My wife is an immigrant,
think?
By the way.
Okay,
so
where is she from?
She's from Korea.
Okay.
So, you know, I understand a lot of the issues with immigration. And I wouldn't want to uproot any family. But
mm-hmm.
70% of the immigrants that come here stay for 5 to 6 years and then go home. And while they're here, they are sending massive amounts of money through wiregrams and what have you back to their families because their main goal is not to stake out any rights or gain citizenship.
Okay, can you just answer my question? What do you think we should do? What would you propose?
Well, I would propose first that we strengthen our security on the border. That's what we have to do. And I think the other thing is we need to reach out to these people that are here illegally, and we need to give them assistance in getting home and in getting whatever resources we can provide so that they can make a living in their own home or to go back and get it at the end of the line. And if they really want citizenship, then they need to start from that point.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I mean, you know, there's a cost to border security and there's a cost to, you know, helping 11 million people go back home and help make a living. And there's also the problem of, you know, let me finish, okay. So
okay.
There's also the question of, you know, what happens when people don't want to leave? How do you force them? Are you going to have U.S. military to forcibly remove people from their homes and families? And so, you know, you can reach out to them, but I would say that most immigrants who want to leave have left, and many people have left because of the financial crisis. But to forcibly remove them, again, is procedurally difficult, potentially inhumane, and it's very costly. When legalizing people who are here actually helps the economy. So to me, the only benefit to doing what you're suggesting is to simply help us feel good about punishing people.
Really? To feel good about punishing people?
Well, it sounds
is
like
that really
you know,
how
you like
feel?
To Well, it sounds to me like you want them to be punished because they broke the law.
If you're driving without insurance,
mm-hmm.
okay, and you get into an accident, do you get taken to court? Are you held to the measure of the law?
Of course, if I speed if I park illegally. I get, you know, there's a different, there are different sorts of, you know, punishment for those things, and I expect it. Often I take risks. I do speed. I park illegally sometimes, and sometimes I'm caught and punished. Sometimes I'm not, but I don't expect, for instance, to be jailed for, you know, parking illegally. You know, I don't expect to be deported for speeding. I mean, there's just, you know, I think there are different proportions to what kind of illegal acts that we commit.
Okay, well, let me ask you a question. Do you know what the penalty is for illegally immigrating to Mexico?
No, I don't. Tell me.
You go to prison for 10 years.
Just like that. If you're caught living in Mexico without proper permit, you get jailed for 10 years?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so you're saying that's what America should do?
I'm not saying that. I'm saying that we're a fair country.
I didn't know that we should be more like Mexico. I'm just curious.
I'm not saying we should be more like Mexico. I'm just saying we should uphold our own laws.
We have to have our own laws. That makes sense for us.
We do have our own laws.
Okay, so we need laws
that
make sense.
If you're not here legally, you go home. And you get in the back of the line.
Okay, well, if you have been here for many years, you have family here, you're married to someone who's a citizen, and there are all people in all kinds of situations, how are you going to get them to leave? I mean, it's just not practical.
Ma'am, if you're
married to... It's not a practical solution to ask
people to leave. Ma'am, if you're married to an American citizen, then you are a registered legal immigrant with a green card. If you're married to an American citizen.
No, that doesn't always happen. There are people who are in prison married to people who are American citizens. I mean, there are all kinds of situations right now. I'm just saying, you know, I hear what you're saying, and if we had all the money in the world, maybe that is a potential solution, but it's not really a practical solution to deport people or ask them to leave when they're not going to want to leave. So that's why we need to do something practical.
We need a practical solution.
Did
you hear what I just said?
We're in a recession. You know, we still have high unemployment. We have half of America either living in poverty or stuck away from living in poverty. I mean, we're in an economic crisis here. You know, we can't spend billions of dollars and trying to get people to leave because they broke a law that we can basically remedy by, you know, trying to recognize their status here. I mean, I really don't understand the kind of punitive approach to it because it's just not practical.
Okay, so but we do have an unlimited source of money because the Federal Reserve keeps printing it every month.
Oh, okay, I'm not going to get into that.
So, but we're in an economic upswing because all these indicators are telling us that we're doing so good. So we've got all these positive things that Democrats and the liberal media has been telling us, and you're telling me that we're still in a recession?
Well, Richard, this is Eric. Let's say let's say things are getting better. Let's say that, you know, we did actually have a bad quarter at the end of 2012. But let's say, you know, that Congress decides that they want to allow our economy to grow now that there's a presidential election coming up. And we have economic growth. And we have the opportunity to invest money in things like education or infrastructure or entrepreneurship, research and development. Or we could spend that money to try to chase down those 11 million people who I think you'd have to agree. You sound like you're angry at them. I'm just asking you, what's more important, investing in America's future or taking some sort of vengeance against those people?
You know what? There's no such thing in my vocabulary as vengeance against those people. It's a matter of the rule of law. And it's a matter of the authorities granted to the federal government under the Constitution. And education and the other things that you mentioned, those are not in the Constitution. And I would say get rid of the Department of Education altogether.
Okay, well, what do you want us to, what do you approve of? I mean, is the only thing that the government is for is to go after people who we don't like?
No, the government is to protect our borders, to defend us in foreign affairs, and to adhere to the founding principles that are laid out in the Constitution, the 20 actions that the government is authorized to do under the Constitution, the Department
okay.
of Transportation, Department of Energy, all that stuff, it should go away because that's not authorized. We need to go
but
back
would,
to the
it
Constitution.
It would be authorized to, I mean, you're talking about mobilizing the United States military inside our borders, right?
No,
creating
sir.
Basically some sort of
no,
train
sir.
Pipeline.
No,
I mean,
sir.
But you would authorize the funding, right, to remove 11 million people from our country, right?
I would authorize funding to find a solution.
Okay.
I do not believe that the military should be involved in it at all.
Okay.
That's
well,
a violation
to,
of our Third
to,
Amendment.
Okay. Well, Richard, we got to let you go. Two more calls. We're going to sneak in the last 10 minutes. Thank you so much. It was enlightening. You added a lot to our conversation, and thank you very much. Appreciate it. We got 707, and then I think we got Joe calling back in. Let's go to 707 first. You are on an immigration town hall with Annabelle Park and Eric Beiler. Tell us your name, where you're calling from, what's on your mind.
Hi, my name's Linda, and I live in Northern California. I just wanted to, I missed the good part of it because somebody called me. Just picking up on what I just heard, I think that a big part of the problem is the people that come into this country illegally are coming in for a better life. If there's a promise of a job, who's giving that job? Those are the people, like the companies and the people that hire under the table or whoever they're doing it. Those are the people that are offering the reason for people to dream to come to this country to have another life, to have a better life. Just going after the, hating, but not hating, but disliking the people who come into this country to try and get a better life is kind of, it doesn't make sense. I think you should go after the people that are offering them very low wages, maybe better than what they get where they are now, but those companies are the ones that are offering the reason for them to come into this country a lot of the time. And it just makes more sense to, if you want to slow the influx, then why not, cut off that pipeline? Because the cheap labor and stuff like that, they're being exploited by these companies. And that seems to be a bigger problem to me. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely, I think a good idea to focus more on, figuring out how to discourage employers who are hiring undocumented employees. But the process really hasn't been perfected. I mean, there are all kinds of problems with E-Verify. For instance, like I've never gone through that process myself, but I don't know if there would be problems because I had to change my name twice when I came here because I adopted an American name, and my papers don't line up, and so it might be a problem for me to go through that process, and it's just not a perfect system, and it might punish the wrong people. It's not, in an ideal world, that would be a great thing to do. But right now, it's actually rather challenging to verify people. But in any case, I think it's in generally that's a good strategy. I think the part I get frustrated with is, you know, when people say this is about law and order. Well, everyone in the debate on all sides agree that we have a broken immigration system. And so instead of trying to enforce a system that's broken, let's fix it. Let's fix the system and then enforce it. We can't just go out and say let's enforce something that's broken. So that's what we have right now. We need to fix it first before we invest a ton of money, because it's going to cost, you know, billions of dollars to enforce immigration laws. Before we invest that kind of money, we have to make sure we have the laws that we are proud of, that reflect our values, that make sense for us. So that's really kind of where I'm coming from. That's what frustrates me, is just people who are reacting by saying, enforce the law, when our laws need to be changed. Okay, so we have Joe calling in. So thanks for calling, Linda. I appreciate what you had to say a lot. So thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, Joe.
Hi. Okay, I'm back. I don't know
how
much of what I had said you had gotten, and I realize we're getting it again. So
yeah, so we're running out of time, so do you want to try it again?
Okay, let me round it up this way. To the best of our abilities, okay, if we can approve an immigration law that is fair to all immigrants. Too much of the conversation revolves around people from our southern border, okay? If they can be resolved to all immigration, all people that are here, okay? I don't think anybody would have a problem. My misgivings, and I dearly hope I'm wrong, okay, is they are members of our Congress and government are just playing a political game with us. And I hope that's not the case, but bearing on past practices that they've done, I can't help but wonder if this thing is really going to happen. I do want it to. I want it to be fair as possible, but I sincerely have my doubts.
Well, Joe, I am more optimistic. You know, we were very close to doing it in 2007, but in 2007, actually, for those of you who've seen 9500 Liberty, in 2007, it was an angry onslaught of emails and faxes that came from something called Numbers USA, sort of an anti-immigrant network. That was ahead of the curve in terms of using the internet and automatic faxes and things like that to organize. I think that the power of that movement, of the anti-immigrant movement at the end of the Bush administration, is part of what inspired the enthusiasm for a Tea Party type of, as Shane said, a corporately funded sort of backlash against the first election of Barack Obama in 2008. But now, I think many people, especially the money bags in the Republican Party, are saying, you know, it's hurting our economy. It's hurting the Republican brand. There really isn't anything to gain with continuing with this approach to immigration that's so divisive. And so really quickly, we have 90 seconds left in the show. What happens when people take a position on immigration that is a them versus us, and it's basically about my anger at Mexicans, basically, and it can't be about anything else? Then they seek out the facts, and they find a line in the Constitution. They find everything they need to find to say it's all about my anger at Mexicans. Then what happens is the average person, unless you are a member of the Latino community or you could be mistaken for one, you say, okay, well, then it's not about me. But the lesson that we learned in 9500 Liberty, what happened at Prince William County, Virginia, is that it is about us, because when we let resentment toward particular cultures affect macroeconomic policy, a lot of times it's the wrong policy and ends up hurting everyone. Last thought, Sanibel?
Yes. Yeah, I just want to say thank you, everyone, for joining, especially all the callers. Thank you so much. I'm glad we got to everyone today. The next town hall is going to be 2 weeks from now, 3:30 to 5:30, and it's going to be about disaster relief and climate change, a much-needed conversation we need to have. But thanks again, everyone, and I will be speaking to you online until then. And goodbye. Oh, and one more thing is we would really appreciate it if you came to our website and signed up to be a member of Coffee Party USA. Thank you. See you in 2 weeks. Bye.